I'm Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and former host here at PW Torch Livecast. If you're looking for my shows, they have moved as of July 2017. They're now called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available through Podcast One. Enter Wade Keller on your podcast app or iTunes and subscribe to the new Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, where I cover Raw and my first show of the week, SmackDown with my second show of the week, and then the Flagship Edition with a co-host, and we cover a broad array of pro wrestling current events, and then I end the week with a weekly interview. That's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, now at Podcast One. Subscribe today. Just search Wade Keller.
Blog Talk Radio.
Wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Indeed it does. From the Polyester Pleasure Palace on the shores of Lake Washington, or as close as I can get in my price range, it's Jim Valley. The show is Wrestling Road Stories, where we take you back to a time when the beer was cold, the rats were hot, people believed it was real, and we sold out everywhere. Everywhere! Yes, indeed, the show that four out of five trailer parks approve, Wrestling Road Stories, here on the PW Torch Livecast with me, Jim Valiant. Sad but true, this is the last one that I'm going to be doing for a while. At least, I don't know. Yeah, you know, I got a new job. Yeah, I've had some ups and downs, as you know. I've talked about them on the show with health issues and things. But I have a new gig, so I won't be able to do this show. And that's because, you know, this show is a set time. And even if I were to move the time, given the nature of this new position, it would not be easy to do. So I will be passing up Wrestling Road Stories in the PW Torch Livecast. But you can still find me on the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast, which you can search on iTunes and find at Pacific Rim Podcast. It's not about the new movie, the new robot fighting movie, the sequel to the robot fighting movie. It's Pacific Rim, because I'm here in Seattle and Fumi Saito, the legendary wrestling reporter and historian, is going to be, he's in Tokyo. So we have that show. You can follow us there at Pacific Rim Podcast. And if you want to cover, we cover Japanese wrestling history. We tie it into American history. We tie it into things happening today. And it's a good show. I think it's an easy listen, about an hour each week, you know, keep you up to date with what's happening in Japan. Talk about history, talk about customs, talk about the significance of people. For example, the Pro Wrestling Observer, the Wrestling Observer just did their Hall of Fame issue. And we talk about Minoru Suzuki. Talk about the Sharp brothers, and we talk about AJ Styles, and all those people had obviously significant careers in Japan, and we talk about those, and we talk about their rate, you know, where they fit in history and those type of things. In particular, the Sharp brothers, you know, the Sharp brothers go back to Ricky Dozan and, you know, television in Japan, and, you know, the origins of pro wrestling in Japan. And I've been voting for them for years, and they finally made it in. I actually missed voting this year, but the year I don't vote for them, they finally make it in. So you can sit each and every week. Usually it drops in the United States Saturday night, Sunday night, Monday, somewhere in there, depending on our schedules with Fumi and I. So follow us, me at Jim Valley on Twitter, and also Fumi at Fumihiko Dayo, FumihikoDayo, Fumihiko Dayo, and the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. And also, I'm doing the Cauliflower Alley Club radio podcast, CAC Radio. We drop that once a month. We did our last one. We had Baron von Raschke on. We talk about the history of Cauliflower Alley and his career. So each week, each month, we'll do something historical on CAC. And then we'll also usually talk to somebody tied into Cauliflower Alley Club. So we'll probably be talking to some of the honorees this year. And also the next one that's coming up, we're going to drop the winner of the Lou Thesz Award. So we'll have that out there. So follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley or on Facebook. You can add me there and you can follow us also at Cauliflower Alley Club. Just search that on Twitter. You can follow us there or CauliflowerAlleyClub.org. And it's a great organization. It's a nonprofit and you can sign up. And the money goes to helping out wrestlers who are down on their luck. For example, Kamala. You know, Kamala has had amputations, and I know they paid, the Cauliflower Alley Club paid to upgrade his van so he has a lift to get into his van. Brian Blair has talked about covering some of Paul Orndorff's house payments. Paul Orndorff was in danger of losing his house, and, you know, he's had health issues as well. And there's been some other things he's talked about. Some of them you can't talk about because of HIPAA laws and things like that, but it's a good organization. So follow me there at Cauliflower Alley Club. And also I'll be there in April and May, late April, May 30th, or April 30th through June the 2nd at the Cauliflower Alley Club reunion at the Gold Coast. It's a fun time. They get seminars. They have wrestling. It's a great way to hang out and talk to people. And, you know, unlike other, you know, the meets and stuff, the fan fests are great. And this isn't a fan fest, you know, so there's not going to be like a million guys there. But of the wrestlers that are there, most of them aren't selling gimmicks. A few are, but a lot of them you can just go up and get a picture and just go up and talk to them, and it doesn't cost you anything. And it's a great way for fellowship and things, so I would encourage you to sign up for the Cauliflower Alley Club and come out in April and May in Las Vegas. It's a lot of fun. It's a good time. So I'll be out there hosting some of the seminars. One of the seminars I can't tell you about, but it's going to be very exciting, at least on paper right now. Hopefully it'll happen, but that's what's going on there. So what's going on today? Well, today we're going to do a show that I've wanted to do for a while. We're going to talk to Mick Karch, who, you know, one of Wade Keller's friends and one of the guys involved in the original AWA in Minnesota. And he was close friends, grew up with Playboy Buddy Rose. Playboy Buddy Rose, of course, is a legend of the Pacific Northwest, and you probably know him best for the blowaway diet. 217 pounds and all of that stuff. And I get it. I mean, it's a gimmick. It was successful for him. It worked out well. But, you know, for me, for a guy who grew up in the Northwest, it's like I know him as so much more. And so we can talk about that, and we'll talk about how he grew up and other aspects of his career. You know, he went through the famous Vern Gagne training camp with Ric Flair and Ken Patera and others. So we'll talk about that and his life in Minnesota. He also went to Texas and helped train the Von Erich boys. He had Kevin Von Erich's first match. So he's really kind of had a fascinating history and a fascinating life. And I believe he had his birthday just the other day, posthumously. And so we'll talk about Playboy Buddy Rose and his life and times today here on the PW Torch livecast. Hey, real quick, let's go to the phone while we can. Let's go to 862. You're on the livecast of Jim Valley. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
It's Kylan, Jim. How are you?
Hey, man. What's going on, Kylan?
Not much. I'm really sad that you have to leave us again because I was looking forward to fulfilling my personal obligations to you of helping you get some guests, but...
Oh, well, that's the way it goes sometimes.
Maybe down the road we'll be able to do something, or maybe if this job doesn't work out for you, I can help you find something else that you might be interested in.
Well, you know, the way my life goes, this job probably won't work out. So you never know. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm very excited. It'll be It'll be a lot of fun. So, again, no, Kylan, I appreciate your support. I appreciate your friendship. And I know that everybody here on the Torch is very fond of you.
I'd like to think so, Jim. So anyway, my first question for this week concerns the rampant nostalgia period that wrestling seems to have experienced since about 2004. And this is something I've always been curious about but never asked on the show before. Why do you think that promoters may feel, and some fans may even want to see older wrestlers or personalities, but current day figures don't get over, so to speak, in today's wrestling?
Well, I mean, it takes time. And I mean, everybody loves the wrestling that they grew up with. You know, it's really funny. You know, as I've mentioned, I've gone back and watched some of the Raws, the early Raws from 93, 94, 95. And I remember being, you know, early 20s and very frustrated in that time because it was so cartoonish with everybody having, you know, Duke the Dumpster Drosy and everybody having a secondary occupation, it seems. And, you know, I was ready, you know, when you're that age, all full of testosterone and vim and vigor, you wanted, you know, a much more adult product. And I was very much ready for that. And obviously, based on the Attitude Era boom that happened, a lot of other people were feeling that same frustration. And now I go back and I watch some of those shows and through a different eye, you know, it's certainly not the best wrestling in the world, but it was much better than probably I gave it credit for. And it's a very easy watch. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. And everything had a point, whether it was a squash match introducing a new wrestler or a squash match getting a wrestler ready for a feud or, you know, some sort of angle on the King's Court or some kind of angle in a match between two major stars. You know, it was much better than I gave it credit for. And I think, you know, you listen to Conrad Thompson, you know, the other day he was talking about one of his podcasts where they mentioned Mike Rotunda as IRS. And, you know, I thought IRS was the most embarrassing, ridiculous thing in the world. That he was going, you know, gee, as a kid, I thought that was the greatest. You know, we'll talk to Mick Karch coming up here in just a couple of minutes. And I think, you know, he'll talk about the wrestling that he liked and grew up with. And I think that's kind of the way it is that everybody wants, you know, where they joined in wrestling and also, you know, a time in their life when they were more nostalgic and give it time. I think everybody, if they're nostalgic for the crap we saw in 93, and also I've noticed some people getting nostalgic about, you know, the early 2000s now and WCW in the late years and things, which is appalling to me that could be the case. You know, I think everyone's nostalgic for whatever they grew up with, and that's just the way of life. So that's kind of the way it works out anyway. Well, thanks for the call, Kylan. I appreciate it, my friend, and thank you for your support, and who knows, maybe I'll be back. Well, look, I've got to take a break. We'll come back with Mick Karch, and we're going to talk about the career of Playboy Buddy Rose, one of my all-time favorites, and maybe if you're lucky, you'll learn some more things about him. There's much more to him than just being the slim trim 217 pounds in the blow-weight diet. We'll talk about that and talk about his career. He did a lot more than you realize. We'll talk about it next here at the PW Torch Livecast.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan, but you might like MMA too. And if so, check out our sister site, MMATorch.com, with live fight event coverage, including UFC pay-per-views, previews of all UFC and Bellator events, the daily news digest, exclusive columns, flashbacks, and much more. Check it out. If you're a fan of MMA, you'll be a fan of MMATorch.com.
It's the PW Torch Livecast with Jim Valley going my first and last, I should say my last, PW Torch Livecast, at least for a while. As I mentioned, I got a new real job, so I don't know that I'm going to have time to do this, but you know, you can still find me. I do a podcast with Fumi Saito from Tokyo, Japan. So here from Seattle to Japan, we call it the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. Each week we analyze and talk about the major news in Japan, and then we also talk about a lot of the history as we build up to history being made in the Tokyo Dome at Wrestle Kingdom 12 with Chris Jericho and Kenny Omega. We've talked about Chris Jericho in Japan. We've talked about what this means. Fumi, as a matter of fact, not Gedo and Jado, obviously they know what they have on their hands, but Fumi is so respected that the upper management in New Japan Pro Wrestling, the people who don't handle the booking, interviewed Fumi because I don't think they fully grasped what they had on their hands with Chris Jericho coming in. So that's how respected Fumi Saito is. So give that a listen. It's a great way if you want to follow Japanese wrestling. It's you know, it's an easy listen. So please give that a listen. I think it's a really smart podcast. I think it's a lot of quality. You're going to get a lot of knowledge out of all the time you put in. It's called the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. It's on iTunes, and you can download it through any podcast app that you have. So check it out. Search for it at Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. Also follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley, and also follow Fumi at Fumi Hikodayo, FumiHikodayo. And speaking of Fumi, when he was a young man in the early 80s, he went to Minnesota, and he was an exchange student, and I know that he knows my guest at this time who's coming on from Minnesota, legendary guy with the AWA, longtime fan, and a guy I'm proud to know, Mick Karch. Mick, how's it going, man?
It's going very well, Jim. It's freezing here. You know, our Minnesota fall, you know, about 87 below zero, but I'm inside, hunkered down, talking to you, and I just want to say something about Fumi, if I could. Starting out here, he probably doesn't share this with you, but during the time that he was in Minnesota, he was part of a group, about 15 guys, that did what was the precursor to backyard wrestling, of which I was a part, and Fumi was a hated heel in our promotion. We called him Mr. Fumi, a variation on Mr. Fuji. And he did every stereotypical Japanese heel maneuver you would want, including the salt in the eyes.
Oh my
now, he probably never told you that. But
no.
That really springboarded Fumi into worldwide acclaim.
That is hilarious. I'm going to call him Mr. Fumi. I'm going to call him Mr. Fumi from now on.
Absolutely.
That is hysterical.
He was good. He was good. He was real devious, and I don't know that he ever achieved main event status, but certainly he was legendary, you know, in front of the 6-7 people that watched us. So he's really a great guy, a great friend, and I've known him for 35 plus years. Super guy.
Yeah, I was really honored that he wanted me to host his podcast with him each week. So we do that. And, you know, as you know, he knows wrestling from the very beginning to today. No knock on anybody, but, you know, he's in Japan and in Tokyo and in the heart of everything. So, you know, when Dave Meltzer was writing about the Sharp Brothers and writing about Minoru Suzuki and those guys in particular, you know, when he wanted some more information on their background, you know, he called Fumi and they talked. And I know Wade in the past has gotten, you know, Japanese news and background from Fumi as well. So, you know, he really is up there, I think, as far as wrestling reporters and wrestling historians go.
No doubt. And again, a real gentleman and just a classy guy.
Yeah, I love him. He's a great guy. So yeah, we do the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. And it's a good thing. So, but anyway, I wanted to get you on here, Mick, because, you know, one of the things I got into wrestling in the 70s, the early, late 70s, watching Portland wrestling, watching Don Owens' promotion. And I grew up right in between Seattle, Washington, and Portland, Oregon. And so back in those days, pre-cable television, we got both the signals for the Seattle TV and the signals for Portland TV. And so we were able to watch the Portland wrestling, the famous Portland wrestling show. And then we would watch the Seattle version called Big Time Wrestling out of Seattle. So you'd watch at 8:30 in the beginning. You'd watch 8:30 until 11 o'clock. You would watch, or maybe, no, 8:30 to 10 o'clock. You would watch the Portland Wrestling Show live, or a little bit delayed, but pretty much live for the Portland Sports Arena. And then you'd turn on at 11 and watch an hour taped, usually the week before, from Portland. So you'd see virtually the entire Portland card where I live. So we were really lucky. And, you know, when I was watching wrestling, that was kind of the heyday of Buddy Rose. By the time I started watching, he had kind of settled into being the top bad guy and feuding with the likes of, you know, Jesse Ventura and teaming with Ed Waskowski and, you know, Steve Regal, Mr. Electricity Steve Regal came through town. And obviously his famous feud with Roddy Piper. But you, did you grow up with Buddy?
I didn't grow up with Buddy. The way that we met was real interesting. We're going back to 1971. And the week before I met Buddy, kind of a backstory, we were huge fans of Nick Bockwinkel's, a group of us, when Nick came into the AWA territory in late 1970. So in June or end of May 1971, Nick was wrestling at the Minneapolis Auditorium, and the group of us were up in the balcony, and we held up a banner that we laid over the edge of the balcony, and it was a pro-Nick banner, Nick is number one, or whatever it said. And long story short, back in those days, you didn't hold up signs at the matches, or they, you know, the ushers gave you heat for it. And so they ripped the banner out of our hands. Comes a week later at the WTCN TV studios in Minneapolis, which is where the AWA TV tapings were every week. This was to be the first night that I met Nick Bockwinkel. And prior to that, prior to meeting Nick at the end of the night, we're all lined up to go into the studio matches. And here's this kid, Paul Pershman. And at the time, Paul, I don't know, he was probably 18, 19 years old. And, you know, we just started comparing notes, and he was a huge Nick Bockwinkel fan. So we were talking about Nick and what happened, you know, the week before, getting the banner pulled out of our hands and whatever. And I was really surprised. I hadn't met Paul before, and I was surprised at how much he really knew about wrestling and about Nick and so on and so forth. So at the end of the night, when we approached Nick, we kind of talked to him about what had happened the previous week with the banner being torn out of our hands and everything else. And Nick, of course, you know, pretended to be amused by it or whatever. But at the time, I asked him if I could start this fan club for him. Well, lo and behold, standing next to me at the time, along with another friend, is Paul Pershman. So on the original permission slip that Nick signed, giving permission to run the fan club, the Bockwinkel Brigade, in his honor, one of the original names on there is Paul Pershman. So that's the way that I actually met Buddy and cultivated a friendship with him, was at the TV studios in Minneapolis in 1971. And what was interesting about it, he was so much a fan of Nick Bockwinkel's. He told me that he was, that he played, I don't know if it was American Legion softball or some community softball or whatever, Paul did, in Richfield, Minnesota. And he said, come on out and watch one of our games. I'd love to have you guys out there. So the first time we went, here the announcer over the loudspeaker is introducing Paul as he comes up to the plate for the first time. And he introduces Paul Bockwinkel. And that's the way that Paul wanted to be known back in the day, that he had some relation, which of course he didn't, but he wanted to be known as a relative, maybe the son, the brother, I don't know, of Nick Bockwinkel. But that's how we met.
That, I've never heard that story before. Paul Bockwinkel. That's
Paul Bockwinkel.
Hilarious.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, you know, you can have 27 members of the Anderson family. What's an extra Bockwinkel, right?
Exactly, right. I mean, there's probably 100 of them out there anyway. I mean, you know, Dennis Bockwinkel and Robert Bockwinkel, the little-known brother or cousin or nephew or whatever, Paul Bockwinkel, 1971.
You know, given the way NXT gives out names, I'm amazed that they haven't named anybody a Bockwinkel yet, but probably give it time.
Oh, it'll get there.
Yeah, it'll get there. What? By the way, I didn't realize this just by coincidence. Today would have been Nick Bockwinkel's 83rd birthday.
Yeah, absolutely. And it for me, it's still hard to believe he's gone. You know, I kind of watched Nick go into the waning, declining years there, the last several years of his life. But, man, time has really flown by, you know, the 2+ years since he passed away. And, you know, in my estimation, my humble, unbiased opinion, still the greatest champion of them all. So happy birthday, Nick, in heaven. And I'm sure he and Ray are tearing it up.
You know, he did some amazing work in Memphis. And I think that given the, you know, Vern Gagne running the AWA the way he did, certainly Nick flourished there. But in more of a Wild West scenario, I think Nick was able to show off even more of his talents and even more versatility by going down to Memphis and doing nothing crazy like Memphis had. But being in that environment, I think it showed even more of his versatility.
He was so versatile, you know, not only Memphis, but when he would go into Amarillo, you know, into Terry Funk country or Houston working for Paul Bosch. He and Ray Stevens went down into the Florida territories when they were the AWA tag team champions. And of course, you know, Nick, you know, going over to Japan, wherever it was that he wrestled, you know, he would adapt and, you know, he would carry everybody, no matter who it was, from the least talented opponent all the way to the best. Yeah, he made him look like $1 million. And to me, that's one of the real legacies of Nick, is how great he was at giving a guy the rub that he might be in the ring with. And just, you know, when he was a heel, having the fans just anticipate, you know, all of a sudden, boom, he came out of nowhere at the end of a match when it looked like he was going to get beat. And that's the mark of a champ. You want people to come back and buy tickets the next time because, you know, darn it, we, you know, so-and-so almost had Bockwinkel. He'll get him next time. Nick was just tremendous in every facet of the word and the consummate champion in and out of the ring, Jim.
You know, you mentioned winning or getting by the skin of your teeth. I think that was one of the hallmarks also of Buddy Rose's success in the Pacific Northwest, doing that. You know, he was kind of pudgy and, you know, not the best at really anything, but he was able to, you know, I think eventually he earned a lot of respect from fans, but, you know, you were able to think, oh, Jesse Ventura is going to finally get Buddy Rose. Jimmy Snuka is going to shut Buddy Rose up, or, you know, Roddy Piper is going to do this to Buddy Rose or Johnny Boyd or whomever. And each time, you know, Buddy was able to skate by.
That was the mark, Buddy Rose. And, you know, I've said this to people. In wrestling history, at least of the modern day, and by modern day, I'm talking about going back to the 1970s, 80s, whatever, Buddy was so underrated as far as the ring general that he was. He had championships. He won titles. You know, he was over in the Pacific Northwest and AWA, and then his couple of runs out in the WWF. But he was so good because he got it. He was one of these guys that was almost in between the old school era and the new school. And when you're trained by Billy Robinson and Vern Gagne, and you, one of your mentors is Nick Bockwinkel, and you've got that old school mentality, you get it. You get the little subtleties. You get the ins and outs. I said ring general. He could call a match. He had brilliant psychology and such simple psychology, too. It was just the old-fashioned, old-school, no-nonsense, black and white. This is a heel move. Do something devious behind the referee's back. There was nothing, you know, inherently flashy about him. I mean, he called himself a playboy and what have you. But as you said, you know, he was pudgy. He looked like he could get beat on any given night. And it was just terrific. From A to Z, he got it. And he was a real professional.
So when did Buddy communicate to you that he was going to follow his passion and go into wrestling? And was that surprising?
Not surprising at all, and he did it right from the beginning. You know, from the very first time that I met him, he was already talking about wanting to get into professional wrestling. And I don't remember if he finished high school or not. I believe he did. Wouldn't swear to it. But I know that even at 18, 19 years old, he was talking about, you know, in a couple of years, this is what I'm going to do. And at the time, he was working, I want to say, as a cashier or carryout or something at a Target store in suburban Minneapolis. And he used to tell stories about how Nick Bockwinkel would come in to buy groceries or whatever, and Black Jack Lanza would come in because Jack lived out in Bloomington. But he always kept his eye on the ball. And, you know, initially when you meet somebody and a guy, you know, he weighed 175, 180 pounds, and he said, I'm going to get into this someday. This is what I'm going to do. You kind of, you know, raise your eyebrow a little bit and you think, well, yeah, okay, well, I've heard this before. And knowing that at Vern Gagne's training camp, you had all these Olympic stars and, you know, former amateur wrestling greats or what have you. And even though Paul was a terrific athlete and a multi-sport athlete, you still kind of think, take it with a grain of salt. Okay, good luck to you, buddy, but you're not going to make it. And, you know, damned if he just kept his eye on the ball and didn't give up. The first time he went out to Vern's training camp, and I'm going to say 1973, not positive on that, but he got the crap kicked out of him. And he basically, you know, he went home and he was determined, you know what, next time Vern has a training camp, I'm going to come out and I'm going to do this again and I'm going to try it again and I'm going to make it. And he did. He did. He did everything they asked him to, from taking the ring from town to town, setting it up, tearing it down, working as a referee, you know, starting in the preliminary matches or what have you. He started at the bottom. And he worked his way to the top. He was tenacious, and it's all he wanted to do in life, Jim, was be a wrestler. And he did it. He did it.
We're talking with Mick Karsh. We're talking about the life of Playboy Buddy Rose. Take a break. We'll be right back here on the PW Torch Livecast. Hold tight.
Rich Van, formerly of the Primetime Friday Livecast with Bruce Mitchell here. I want to tell you about my new show, The Deep Dive with Rich Van. On Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern weekly, join us as we dive into a single subject, some weeks as serious as race, gender, and stereotyping in wrestling, to as fun as which IC champs could fit into another era, and anything in between. We'll have guests from inside and outside the Torch family to cover the subject of the week, and of course your calls and emails. Prior to each episode, I'll put out on social media the subject and some notes, places where you can also bone up on the subject of the week if you're so inclined. I'll also devote shows to two of my favorite international promotions, New Japan Pro Wrestling and Progress. All are welcome. No secret handshakes here because Saturday nights on the livecast are officially all right for diving.
PW Torch Livecast, Jim Valley. It's going to be my last wrestling road story, at least for a while. I've got a new gig, but you can still follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley. Also, I'm doing the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast each week with legendary reporter and historian Fumi Saito. So please follow me there. Just search for Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast through the App Store or wherever your podcast app is, and it should come up once a week. We do an hour talking about Japanese wrestling, the big stories, plus history, lots and lots of history. So you'll get something out of it for sure, because Fumi is one of the most knowledgeable reporters and historians anywhere in the world. So check that out, Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. And I'm also doing, very honored to be doing the hosting for CAC Radio, Cauliflower Alley Club Radio, for the Cauliflower Alley, one of the legendary groups in pro wrestling. We do that once a month. We've got a show up right now with the Baron Von Raschke, who's going to be receiving the top award in 2018, the Mike Mazurki Award. So we'll talk to award winners, we'll talk history of the Cauliflower Alley Club, and much more. So follow me. You can go to the page at cauliflowerallyclub.org, and the radio show is right there. But you can also follow me on Facebook, Jim Valley, or on Twitter, at Jim Valley. So either one. But I'll still be doing some podcasts, so please follow me there for the time being. But right now we're talking to one of Fumi and Wade Keller's good friends, Mick Karsh, about the life of Playboy Buddy Rose. Buddy went through the camp with Flair and Patera, didn't he?
He did. And I remember very, very well back in the day. He would tell me horror stories about Vern's camp. And the way that the guys have described Vern's camp over the years, almost to a man, up to and including guys like Ricky Steamboat and Sergeant Slaughter and even Flair, I mean, this was just a living hell because Vern meant business. You didn't just, you know, pay your money, go through the camp, as, you know, a lot of the indie promotions sadly do today. They just want to get your money and put you out there with as very little training as possible. You really went through the meat grinder, and this is from day one, where you would come in and do 500 squats, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, what Flair described on the ESPN 30 for 30 was absolutely true. And I remember that Buddy would always tell me there were two guys in particular in the training camp, especially the first year that he went out, that absolutely brutalized him. One of them was Larry Hainimi, who eventually, of course, became Lars Anderson in the business. And the other was Billy Robinson. And I don't know if they didn't like Buddy or what the situation was, if they saw him as a guy who maybe had a little too much attitude and needed to be put in his place. But I know that Larry Hainimi always wanted to get Buddy into the ring and just stretch him from pillar to post. And Billy Robinson, Buddy told me one story that has stayed with me for years. One of the first days in camp, Robinson is in the ring with Buddy, and they were doing a collar-to-elbow hookup. And what Robinson said was, all right, I want you to move me. That's all you got to do, move me. Move me off my feet. And the way that Buddy described it was that for about the next half hour to 45 minutes, they basically maintained this collar-to-elbow hookup with Buddy attempting to move Billy Robinson off his feet. Couldn't do it, and he was so exhausted, according to what Buddy told me, that at the end of this session, Buddy was on his hands and knees, basically upchucking in the middle of the ring out of his exhaustion, and Billy Robinson is doing jumping jacks and four-count burpees and everything else while he's calling Buddy names, basically to light a fire under him. So, yeah, when you say he went through the camp, he sure did, Jim, and he went through it. And you can imagine, he takes this beating, this horrific beating from Robinson and Hainimi and whoever else, and comes back the next year. That talks to his tenacity and how much he wanted to be a wrestler.
Now, did Buddy, I'm trying to remember, did someone once say, did Buddy resent Billy Robinson for all of this treatment?
I don't know. Well, you know, he didn't tell me that he resented Robinson. He just kind of explained what kind of a trainer Billy was. I think in later years, in retrospect, he realized that it was legitimate training. A lot of people I've heard talk negatively about Billy Robinson over the years. I mean, because of the shooter that he was. And if Billy liked you and respected you, you were in good. If he didn't like you, you were going to find out in a hurry. A legendary story about Nick Bockwinkel. Somebody asked Nick, what were your greatest matches in the AWA? And Nick would always say they were with Billy Robinson. And then when pressed a little bit about, you know, well, what kind of a guy was Robinson? We heard he was a bully. He was hard to deal with, etc. Nick would always say the best thing to do at the beginning of the night, if you're going to work with Billy Robinson, would be to walk into the locker room, sit down with him, say, Billy, what do you want to do tonight? And then whatever Billy said, he went out and did. And he said that way you stayed on his good side and had hellacious matches with him. So Robinson was a no-nonsense guy. I think Buddy probably respected him. But, I mean, let's face it. I mean, any guy that kicks the crap out of you, you know, day after day for hours at a time, and belittles you and calls you names, whether or not the motive is to get you hardened to be in the business, you're going to have a little lasting wound. So did he resent Billy Robinson? I don't know. Might not have been his favorite guy, but I know he respected him.
You know, what's interesting is also in Portland and through other parts of his career, his finisher was that Billy Robinson inside-out backbreaker.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, there it is. And that may answer the question whether or not he had a distaste for Billy Robinson. He certainly respected him enough. I know that Ray Stevens was a guy that that Buddy really looked up to. So he definitely, I think he took a little piece out of a lot of the guys, a little memento, a little bit of homage to his trainers as he went along.
Hey, we've got a Twitter question here, which is kind of an interesting question from Brian Alston. Can you think of anybody on the current scene or anybody recently that might be that you could compare to Buddy Rose? And there's nothing I can think of off the top of my head.
You know, I don't think so, because you immediately, when you think about the current scene, you go to the WWE, and because so much of what they do is flash and glitz, and so programmed and so directed and scripted as far as a guy's character, I don't know that anybody right now really. I think Buddy was too old school to be really compared to anybody on the modern wrestling scene. And he was a good mix too, because while he wasn't flashy, he had enough of the personality where he stood out a little bit. And then you have his pudginess and his look. I wish I could be more specific, but yeah, I'm like you, Jim, off the top of my head, I don't know that there's anybody that I would really say, hey, yeah, he reminds me of Buddy Rose back in the day.
You know, there's, I guess, the closest thing, and this isn't even that close, but maybe a little bit of Kevin Owens, in the sense that Kevin's not a body guy. Kevin kind of brags a lot and then goes out and does what he says. But the thing with Buddy's character is Buddy would win usually by the skin of his teeth, and oftentimes it was kind of him getting lucky. I mean, certainly, like if he was running a guy out of town, a lot of times since that guy was leaving, Buddy might win strong to keep the territory strong. But generally speaking, he usually was kind of losing, kind of like Flair did in his championship days. Buddy, I always compare to, and it's not an exact comparison, but, you know, both he and Tommy Rich were kind of on top in the territory days. And then as things went national, there was a shift to bodies, and they didn't change their body type. And, you know, kind of got left behind as everything shifted to a much more aesthetic purpose and kind of the Muscle Man Hulk Hogan era, where you had to have the big body. And so I think fans saw them as something less than they were because they didn't have the abs or the chest or the arms.
That is really a great point. I mean, not only that point about the transition of the business and the body type, but your point about Kevin Owens as well, I think is great. If anybody was going to be, you know, somewhat compared to Buddy, at least in body type and wrestling style, it would be Kevin Owens. I think back in the day, maybe in the 80s, when, you know, even before he got real heavy, Adrian Adonis didn't have the greatest physique in the world. You know, he was a little bit larger than Buddy in terms of height and a little bit larger in size. But Adonis also had that, you know, kind of pudgy appearance, but he would bump his ass off like Buddy did, you know, the over-the-top flip in the corner and things like that. So maybe Adonis back then, certainly Kevin Owens today. I absolutely agree with you.
You know, it's interesting because everybody knows Buddy, you know, primarily for his AWA tag team run and then the blowaway diet. But for me, and I don't know how you feel about this, for me, those are kind of, in my opinion, kind of sad points in Buddy's career, because he wasn't as, you know, dominant and carrying the territory like he was in Portland. And certainly he had a run with Bob Backlund and things, but it's like, it was kind of sad him being, in my mind, being the big fat comedy character doing kind of the humiliating blowaway diet. And then also, you know, kind of the dying days of the AWA, and I prefer to remember Buddy as in Portland and being much more dominant and less as a joke that I think he was in on, but I think the Buddy Rose character wasn't in on the joke.
Here's what I would say to that, and I agree with you in a lot of respects, especially when you say that it was sad that a lot – because wrestling fans are transient, and it's transitional to follow the business. If you didn't see Buddy Rose, not only in the Portland days, but in his early AWA days, up to and including, I would say, you know, when he came into WWF for his first run with Bob Backlund, I thought he was really impressive, and I really thought, for some reason, I don't know why, I thought they were going to put him over and give him the championship. They didn't. I don't think he really lost his luster on the first go-around in WWF, but certainly when they brought him back towards the end, that blowaway diet was just – and you're right, but he may have been in on the joke, and he might have been getting – It was typical. It was it's what happened with Adrian Adonis when Adrian ballooned, and you know they gave him the flower shop gimmick in WWE or WWF at the time. It was sad, and what was even sadder, Jim, is that for friends of buddies like me, and maybe you know you as well. We were watching his demons catch up with him, and even though he was a good worker, a great worker, no matter what he weighed at the time, it was still, we saw this guy letting himself go. He could still, you know, call a match, do extremely well in a match, but we're still seeing kind of the implosion of Buddy. And it became more sad as the years went on. I know the last time I saw him at Cauliflower Alley, I hadn't seen him for years, and I was just appalled by the way he looked. And there was nothing good that was going to come out of his physical health at the time. And he was obviously a ticking time bomb. But getting back to the original point, I think even in the AWA in the 80s, when he was teaming up with Doug Summers and he started doing this 217-pound gimmick, he hadn't ballooned to like the, you know, the 350, 400 pounds that he did later on in life, and he could still really go. And he and Summers, I mean, the matches with the Midnight Rockers were just off the charts, just phenomenal. And so I still had it then into the 80s, into the middle 80s. But I do think that when he went back for that next run in WWE, that was catastrophic. That was just an embarrassment, and he didn't deserve that. You know, certainly he was collecting a paycheck, and he was in the twilight of his career. But those of us who knew him and respect him were really taken aback by it.
Yeah, and he came back to Portland after that and did a tag team with Paul New, who was known as Avalanche and PN News later on, and they were. They were the Beach Boys, and they wore swim shorts and board shorts and stuff. And the joke was they were the Beach Balls. And I know that he wanted to be back on top in Portland, but he wasn't booking. And I think there was some frustration there. But yeah, it was kind of a sad decline. We'll talk more about Buddy Rose with Mick Karch coming up in just a moment. It's Jim Valley here on the PW Torch Livecast. I'm going to be wrapping up my tenure here, but you can still follow me on Twitter. At Jim Valley. You can also listen to my PW Tour or my Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast with Fumi Saito. Search for it on wherever you listen to your podcast, Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. We talk about pro wrestling history throughout the world and throughout history. And then also we talk about the latest and the big stories in Japan and provide some context for you, particularly talking about right now the history of wrestling at the Tokyo Dome. As we gear up to Wrestle Kingdom 12. So check it out, Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. You can still find me there and also find me doing CAC radio for the Cauliflower Alley Club at cauliflowerallyclub.org. But we'll talk some more Playboy Buddy Rose coming up next.
Support what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast when you shop Amazon. Simply go to pwtorch.com/Amazon. We've simplified the page. There's a big Amazon logo. You click on it. It takes you right to Amazon's homepage. But because of that small detour, we get credit for your visit, and we get a commission on anything you buy on that shopping trip. That's pwtorch.com/Amazon. thank you very much for your support.
PW Torch Livecast, Jim Valley here on Wednesday. Follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley. Also search for Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. It's a great show I do each week with Fumi Saito. But we're talking about Playboy Buddy Rose, who was really a legend here in the Pacific Northwest. And I know you'd mentioned, Mick, that you kind of lost contact with Buddy a little bit while he was here. But, you know, were you surprised how successful he became here in Portland?
I wasn't surprised at all. Once he got rolling in the business, it was just a matter of time. He was going to do it. And once he cleared that first hurdle, getting into wrestling itself, then there was no stopping him. There was no question in my mind, because he was so very, very talented and so driven. I wasn't surprised by the championships. Like I said, what surprised me was that he didn't go over on Bob Backlund in New York. I really thought that was going to happen. So, yeah, no, I wasn't surprised at all. I was very glad and happy for his success. And yet I didn't have, just to a point that you were making, I didn't have constant contact over the years. But I know when he first left the AWA, we had contact when he was wrestling down in Texas. And then later on, if he was wrestling in Japan, he would call me 3-4 o'clock in the morning, you know, and back in the day when I had an answering machine that was turned on, you know, I'm in the middle of a deep sleep and I hear, "Karch, pick up the phone, it's Buddy Rose," you know, and he would call incessantly until I picked up the phone. He knew darn well what the time difference was in Japan, but he would always claim that he didn't know it, that he forgot that there was this time difference. And, "Oh, I'm so sorry that I called you, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning." So we did maintain contact. I know a lot of times, I don't know the specifics, but he would tell me, "Such and such is coming up. There's a TV opportunity here or there, and I'm going to try to get your name into the hat." He was always very supportive of me, which I really appreciated. Sadly, none of that stuff came to fruition, but he always went to bat for me. And, you know, I guess that's what a friend does. One story I got to tell, Jim, if you don't mind, and this is before he got into the business. And this is kind of a legendary story. This is when Paul, Buddy, was trying to gain weight to get into the wrestling business. And he probably weighed about $180, $185 at the time. And we would hang out and we would, you know, go play pinball or whatever, watch wrestling tapes at his apartment. That was another story altogether. But he comes over to my apartment one night and he says, "I'm kind of hungry. Do you mind if I take a piece of cheese and some chocolate milk?" I said, "No, it's in the refrigerator. Go help yourself." So I go to the living room and I'm putting on a wrestling tape or whatever. And I turn around and hear Buddy Rose has a 2-pound block of Velveeta cheese with the aluminum foil. He's got it unwrapped about halfway down this big block of cheese. He's munching right from the block of cheese, didn't bother to take out a butter knife or anything else and cut himself a slice. Why would you do that when you can just unwrap the cheese? So he's munching on this cheese like a rat in a rat trap. And on the other hand, he has this half gallon of chocolate milk that he's opened up, and he's drinking from the half gallon of chocolate milk. Again, why go into the cupboard and ask for a cup, you know, an 8-ounce glass, whatever? So basically, in the course of about 10 minutes, he drank a half gallon of my chocolate milk, ate my all my Velveeta cheese. And I never let him forget it all those years.
You know, one of the things that Buddy, I have a friend who went on a road trip with Buddy one time, and they went into a store, and Buddy came out with a full gallon of milk and a full chocolate cake.
Oh, doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, your story phases me about zero. So, yeah, I'm not surprised by that at all.
You know, we used to go down, again, before he got into the business, God bless him, we would go down to the Dykeman Hotel in Minneapolis, which is housed the AWA wrestling office. We'd go down on Saturday afternoons and wait for the boys to come in and schmooze with them or get their autographs or what have you. And one of our favorite restaurants was a place called the Forum Cafeteria. It was about a block from where the Dyckman Hotel was. So we used to go in there. We'd play pinball first, and, you know, Buddy was always borrowing quarters for me to play the pinball machines, never paid me back a dime. And then we would go over to this Forum Cafeteria. And I'm telling you, you know, unless you're Haystack Calhoun or the McGuire twins or Happy Humphrey or whoever, I've never seen a guy ever to this day load up his plate the way Buddy did, to the point where as he's walking through, people are just like, is that possible? And they would look to see where this guy was going, because surely his family had to be at the table. He's bringing that much food, and he's taking the food over for his family. But no, it was Buddy. It was all his, and it was just an amazing, amazing sight.
You know, Buddy did do some pretty amazing things, too. One thing that I didn't know until I read Bob Backlund's autobiography, but, you know, right before superstar Billy Graham came back with his karate gimmick, Buddy was his opponent in the Garden and had a match in the Garden and all around the territory, as you well know. And, you know, I didn't know this because obviously I was in the Northwest, so I didn't know how well Graham was drawing. But apparently, according to Backlund, you know, Graham looked so different and was so lethargic and didn't have that spark anymore that the fans didn't buy it, and he drew terrible. And a lot of promoters, I guess, particularly in Philadelphia and some other areas, didn't use Graham and used Buddy around the horn again. And Backlund praised Buddy, saying that he was always willing to do whatever to make the match look good, and that he was a pretty good drawing opponent as far as Backlund's career went. And I thought that was pretty high praise coming from Bob Backlund.
Oh, absolutely. It was. And, you know, you mentioned Billy Graham back then, too. And I recall he came into the AWA, too, right about that time for a stint, and just looked completely different, you know, with the shaved head and how he was doing the karate gimmick. It was definitely not the same superstar Billy Graham. But, yeah, high praise from Bob Backlund for Buddy. It's interesting, too, and I don't know if Buddy had ever mentioned this to you, Jim, but during his AWA run with Doug Summers on top, Buddy said, and I guess it can be verified, that he never lost a fall while he and Doug Summers were tag team champions. And it was always Doug that did the job, whether it was one fall, two out of three falls, whatever. Buddy said, you can look it up, I never lost a fall when Doug and I were tag team champions. And I, you know, Doug never complained about it. So, you know, yeah, that's certainly deference and a tip of the hat to Buddy. But that's, yeah, I'd like that to be verified. You know, I've got no reason to doubt Buddy, God bless him. But supposedly he never dropped a fall.
Was there decent money? Could one make a full-time living during that time when he was tag team champions in the AWA? Was there enough money, or was that kind of just a part-time gig?
You know, I think there was. The AWA was always a real good-paying territory. Certainly not in the early 80s with Hulk Hogan, it was just through the roof as far as the payoffs are concerned. But Buddy always, he would never tell me exactly what he made back then, but he said it was pretty decent. And you got to remember back, you know, when they were working here, you had the Midnight Rockers as opponents. Leon White was in, Scott Hall, Kurt Hennig. So the talent roster was still pretty adequate, and the AWA had some good TV back then. I'm not sure how they did on the road as far as house shows are concerned, but I know that with TV contracts and everything else, I'm sure he could make a pretty good deal, because Buddy wouldn't have come here. He wouldn't have come back. I know he had heat with Vern for a long time, and the way he described it to me, right after he had left the AWA territory the first time and went out on the road, he called, he was working in Texas, and he told me a story about how Vern was really mad at him because Vern had, I don't know if it was a written agreement or a verbal agreement, that his trainees would give Vern a percentage of their income for, I believe it was 5 years or what have you. And I know Flair has talked about this too. But Buddy called me up and he said, I'll probably never come back to Minneapolis, never come back to Minnesota, because I'm not giving Vern a dime. He's all over me about it. Ray Stevens, who was down in Texas as well, basically told Buddy, look, Vern isn't booking you anymore. You're done with him. You owe him nothing. Don't pay him anything anymore. And because of that, Buddy was gone for many years until he came back in 1986, I believe, 85, 86. And I don't think he would have come back to the AWA territory had it not been lucrative enough for him to come back, especially if he had to patch things up with Vern in order to come back. I'm sure he made enough.
One of the things that was interesting about that run is that they didn't win by pinfall, which seemed kind of ridiculous. Do you know any history behind that? Was that a Vern call? Was that Scott Hall and Kurt Hennig being difficult? I mean, I know that Hennig obviously got a lot of help from Buddy throughout his career, and it seems odd that he wouldn't want to repay Buddy for everything he did for him, particularly in Portland.
You know, I think it was probably a Vern call. I don't know for sure. I started in the AWA, as sadly, I wish I would have had the opportunity to work with Buddy back then, but he was gone for about a year before I started in the AWA. I would guess it to be Vern's call, but, you know, face it, as you look back over history, well, not the first time there was a silly call or a championship dispute or something in the AWA. Happened all the time with disqualifications or countouts or whatever. So it, yeah, and who knows? I mean, it may have been, you know, Kurt may have had some influence. I kind of doubt it. I think at the time it was, let's just do this.
Somebody sent me a message. Wrestler Weekly wanted me to talk briefly about Buddy's run with Jay Youngblood. And that was, of course, the famous angle where Buddy threw the Pacific Northwest Heavyweight Championship off the Fremont Bridge in downtown Portland. And for those who don't know, Portland, Oregon is divided. It's cut up by the Columbia River, which goes through downtown. And so there are about six or so bridges that cross the river, and the Fremont is one of them. And Buddy, I think, according to Buddy, copied this angle from Paul Jones, who did it in Florida. And I think when Steve Austin did it in the WWF 20-some years later, or maybe 10, yeah, almost 20 years later, I think they got that from Paul Jones as opposed to Buddy Rose, but that's what Buddy did. He said on TV he was going to throw it off, and there was a ton of fans there. Rich Patterson, who was Buddy's close friend in Portland for many years while he was here in Portland, has the videotape of it, and I don't think he's going to – he cleaned it up because it's on a different format than is common these days. It's on a very early home taping format. But I don't think he's going to make it public because let's just say that the wrestling fans who are there say some very, very politically incorrect names. They call the Buddy and his clan some names that would be hate crimes. Well, today they would be hate crimes today. And they are talking about some things that maybe those gentlemen might do together. So you understand.
Buddy was gutsy.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that. You know, I mean, he might not have been the toughest guy in the world, but he wouldn't back down from anybody. And I'm quite sure, you know, if you're going back to the 80s, stuff that they got away with saying back then, they'd never get away with saying today. I don't mean to hijack your show here, but here's another thing I wanted to talk to you about, Jim, and another little-known fact. We mentioned earlier on about Fumi Saito getting involved in our backyard wrestling. Buddy did the same thing. Before he got into the business, and again, we're looking at 1971, 1972, the precursor to the backyard wrestling stuff, and Buddy wrestled me probably a handful of times, and we would wrestle on anything from beach blank, you know, with newspaper rope around the ring to gym mats, whatever. We would actually wrestle, and Buddy was a masked man, and he was wearing actually a ski mask a legitimate ski mask, might have been just as well heading to rob a bank. He was wearing a ski mask, and we called him, of all things, we called him Dr. Death way before Steve Williams, and we would wrestle outside in the summertime in about 120 degrees, Buddy in this ski mask, and of course, you know, I went over by disqualification. He wouldn't do the job for me straight out, but he actually gave me what was my first and relatively last bump in a wrestling ring. When he started working for Vern, he was very close friends with Dennis Bockwinkel, who was wrestling in the AWA as Dennis O'Brien. And Buddy and Dennis would work together on setting up and taking down the ring in Milwaukee and Chicago and Green Bay and what have you. So one particular afternoon, Buddy said to me, you know what, if you want to put on a show up in my neck of the woods up here in Richfield, Minnesota, I'll get you the ring. I'll talk to Dennis. We'll get the AWA ring. All we got to do is make sure we clean the mats. Vern and Wally will never be any the wiser. They'll never know anything about it. So sure as hell, one summer afternoon, here we are. We're out in the middle of an intersection up in Richfield, Minnesota, suburb of Minneapolis, and we got the ring set up. And I took my first body slam in a professional wrestling ring from Buddy Rose, Paul Pershman at the time. And I want to tell you, first of all, I went up like crap. I gave him no help whatsoever in jumping up for the body slam. So to get even with me, hoisting my carcass up, he delivered, let's just say, a little extra authority, a little extra impetus to the body slam. And being a novice, I had no idea how to disperse the shock or anything else. I'm lucky that I got out of there uncrippled. And that was the first and last time. And he continued to rib me about it again for the next 30 years. Another little known fact, Buddy Rose was a backyard wrestler back in the 1970s.
You know, one of the things that Buddy also did is when he left Minnesota, he went down to Texas and he had Kevin Von Erich's first match. And he helped out with the training of the Von Erichs, which, you know, Buddy was certainly developed into a very good wrestler, a very good professional. But it seems awfully early in his career to be helping out with training. So that, I think that says something about how quickly he got to a level that even Fritz Von Erich wanted him in the ring with his kid.
That's why I said it before. He got it. He knew right away. He had great trainers, I'm sure, having Gagne and Robinson and Hainini and guys like that to help train him and get him into the business. He was ready. I mean, he was way ahead of his time in terms of being ready to grow and expand in the business. He was a ring general. Like I said, the psychology was second to none, and he was destined for greatness. And I think it's sad. I mean, you and I talk about how good he was, and his fan base knows how good he was. But in the annals of wrestling in the 80s, I think he should be rated a lot higher than he is instead of just an afterthought. You know, here's a guy wrestle in the very first WrestleMania match, you know, as the executioner against Tito Santana. Buddy does not get the credit that he deserves. Part of it, I think, goes back to what I said before about the transition, where a lot of people might not remember him except when he started to put on the weight and then the cartoon character kicked in. So it's a shame. His legacy should be much better than the blowaway diet.
You love pro wrestling podcasts, but you might not have time to listen to all of them. We'll help you decide which ones to listen to and keep you up to date on the ones you're missing at pwpodcasts.com. That website features written recaps of all of the top pro wrestling related podcasts, including Steve Austin, Bruce Pritchard, Edge and Christian, and so on. Check it out. It's pwpodcasts.com, your home for written recaps of all pro wrestling personality hosted podcasts.
Did he ever express any sadness about that? I mean, as I mentioned, you know, the business kind of changed and they wanted body guys. And, you know, chances are that if he would have done what so many others did, he probably would have had the same fate as those other people. But did he ever express any regret that he kind of got left behind?
It was kind of an oh well. The best thing I can compare it to, when I was working with Terry Taylor, we were doing some AWF TV back in the late 90s, and we would talk about the Red Rooster gimmick and how so many people said, geez, you know, that's what you're going to be remembered by. And he said, look, I made money. You know, I was, you know, towards the end of my career, as it were, and made more money than I ever made before. But he didn't really express regret to me. I think one point I said to him, you deserve much better than that. And he was just kind of philosophical about it. You know, it is what it is. And sadly, I think what happens, Jim, is when your weight becomes your gimmick, which it did, it was almost he was going to be pigeonholed. There was nothing at the time. And if Vince is encouraging him to keep putting on weight, which Buddy used to say, all of you guys, you got to be at the gym at 6 o'clock in the morning, except for Buddy Rose. He playing off the gimmick, it just was what it was. And whether or not if he had regrets, he didn't say anything about it. It was more or less resignation, I think.
You know, and I know that he was in the WWF in the early 80s as far as he was getting a little bit of a push with Bobby Heenan. He wrestled under the mask as the Executioner at WrestleMania 1, and he says that George Scott, who was the booker at the time, wanted him under the mask because he had plans for him. And I know that he did a couple of TV squashes again with Bobby Heenan. He had a brief appearance on Piper's Pit, which didn't seem like they gave him much to say. They let Bobby do a lot of his talking, and it was kind of a throwaway thing. But, you know, according to Dave, Buddy was found, you know, passed out in a locker room and let go. And, you know, as you mentioned, kind of his demons caught up with him. But even if his demons hadn't caught up with him at that point and he moved forward, I just don't see that he would have had a spot in the WWF or a decent spot. I kind of see him as maybe he would have kind of been used like Pedro Morales in that era, kind of a jobber to the stars. I just didn't see that he would make it work.
You hit it right on the head before when you talked about the transition of the business from the body types. And, you know, again, you're talking an era where all of a sudden it was the muscle guys and it was the glitz. And the old school guys were generally pigeonholed into that role, just as you said, an enhancement guy with enough name recognition that people knew who they were, they remembered them or what have you. But they did the same thing with like a Butcher Vachon type character, where they would bring them back just for name value, but without any real plans in mind. So I agree with you, even if the demons had not gotten to him, which tragically they did, the business was changing, and the Buddy Rose types, I think, were kind of dinosaurs at that point.
And he was also, you know, kind of a complicated character. He had his issues with, you know, when he was married to Tony Bourne's daughter and Matt Bourne's sister. There were some things there. I mean, he's a very complicated and complex person, kind of like all of us. We all have our good and our bad. But I mean, as far as being here in Portland, you know, he made a lot of people and he had a lot of different top talents to work with. Do you know, one of the things that's interesting is Steve Regal, not to be confused with William Regal from the WWE, but
right.
Mr. Electricity from, I believe, is he an Indianapolis guy?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So he came in and he was a top babyface for a little while, and then he got a shoulder injury and he didn't drop the title in the ring. He vacated it. And it's up on YouTube. You can see this where Buddy Rose cuts an interview up in the crow's nest and he calls Regal a coward and gutless. And I think it looks like he's legitimately mad that Regal wouldn't even do like a quick match or any sort of thing to drop it back in the ring, because Regal just left town and never came back. Did you ever talk to Buddy about that?
You know, I didn't, and I got to look at that tape to find out if it was a shoot or, as they say, a work shoot. I wish I would have talked to him about that. And it's interesting because Regal is one of those guys, he just kind of dropped off the planet as far as the wrestling business is concerned. So that's very interesting. I will have to Have to check that out. But no, he never said anything to me about that. In latter years, Jim, our contact was really infrequent. I would see him at Cauliflower Alley a couple of times along with Ed Waskowski. And we would kind of reminisce a little bit. Back in the 80s, Ed and Buddy were roommates here in Minneapolis, and they lived in the same apartment complex with Sherry Martel and I believe Scott Hall. They all kind of lived together. So we would talk about that and kind of the older days. Every once in a while, he would make reference to, and this isn't toes here or talking out of bounds. Every once in a while, he would make reference to just not really being too happy at that point in his life. You could see it, you could hear it. But again, back to your original point, no, he didn't say anything about that. I was just alluding to the fact that our contact and our interaction and talking about the business later in life with him was more focused on his glory days.
You know, that's one thing I'd forgotten about. When Buddy was in New York the first time in 82, 83 with Bob Backlund, he would bring, because he's Playboy Buddy Rose, he would bring valets to the ring. And, you know, that really wasn't that common in that era. Obviously, Gorgeous George had done it many years before, but in that era, it wasn't very common to do that. And one of the valets that he brought to the ring was sensational Sherry Martel.
It was. They were friends, you know, going back to that point. And it's interesting that you talk about that, because you're right. Outside of like the Gorgeous George, there wasn't that valet thing kind of going, but the whole gimmick with him was terrific. I remember, you know, and they're still up on YouTube, those old primitive promos that he would cut where he's getting off the jet plane, the private plane, or he's getting into the limo, or there he's got a couple of good-looking girls rubbing his fingers as he's laying on the beach. So he really was kind of living that lifestyle, and I guess you could maybe say there was some kind of a link to Ted DiBiase's Million Dollar Man character on a smaller scale. But
yeah,
again, it was the lifestyle that Buddy portrayed. And oh God, I remember so well him getting into the ring with the valets, and they would take his robe off his shoulders. And even then he was getting a little bit pudgy, so he would kind of wiggle his hips and his arms while they were taking the robes off. But even then you could see this guy got it. He understood it. He got the easy heat, and he did it so well.
And he was a very early adopter. He, like as we've mentioned in the past, he had a VCR way before many people did. He had formats that don't exist anymore that his friend Rich Patterson has had to search high and low and pay a lot of money to have redone. So if you see any of Buddy's stuff from Portland Wrestling, particularly the early and mid-80s and late 70s, that's from Rich Patterson, because Buddy was a very early technological adapter before VHS and Beta became popular. He had a different format, but Buddy would go on vacation to Hawaii or as a stopover on his way to Japan, and he would film himself on the beach at Waikiki with women rubbing lotion on his body and do a promo about how he was living the good life and all of, you know, how the money he had and the jets and all the fine living in Las Vegas and all of those things. So Buddy was really far ahead, particularly for a territorial guy, doing those types of promos and vignettes.
He was way ahead of his time, and he was so smart. I don't know how much of I'll say this. If they gave him a character, if they said you're going to be Playboy Buddy Rose, he ran with it. He was so smart. He was like an Eddie Gilbert, I would compare him to, just an absolute genius for the business. And right from the get-go, right from the outset, here's a guy who followed the dream, and he knew what worked, and he was creative and innovative. And that's why I say, you know, to those of the younger generation or those who may have come onto the peripheral edges of old school and then into new school, if the Buddy Rose that you know is only the one that sat there with an electric fan blowing powder off his belly, you really don't get the essence of Buddy Rose.
You know, and he carried Portland for years, you know, made a lot of guys. It was very common that, you know, whether it was Ron Starr or Rocky Johnson would come in and they would do a TV match with Buddy, and they would get all of the offense and look like a Buddy would make them look like $1 million. Like, this was going to be the guy that was finally going to rid the Northwest of Playboy Buddy Rose. And it worked. You know, he was very unselfish. Bob Backlund talks about it in his book, and many opponents talk about it. It's just, you know, Buddy was oftentimes, and maybe honestly at times to a detriment for his own good, about putting people over and making opponents for the future.
It's interesting that you say that, because I had mentioned Nick Bockwinkel a little bit earlier on. I think there's a parallel, too, with Nick and Buddy and how good they made the opponents look. That's why I think they're head and shoulders, in my estimation, and a lot of people question me about this. A guy like Ric Flair, great wrestler, no question about it. But Flair's matches had a sameness to them and a predictability to them. And even though he made guys look like $1 million, I mean, it's well documented. It's very obvious that the signature Flair moves, whether it was the flip into the corner or the, you know, the face plant, you know, after somebody punched him in the nose or whatever, became very predictable. Buddy's matches, like Bockwinkel's matches, were not that way. And he sensed the crowd. He sensed the atmosphere. He sensed what was working and what wasn't. And he tailored his match to that. And again, that's the legacy, and that's the essence of the guy.
And again, I do want to mention, you know, he wasn't always the nicest guy, wasn't always the best role model, but, you know, I think as far as his in-ring work goes, it was very good. And there's more, like you said, to the Buddy Rose career and the Buddy Rose person than just the blowaway diet or his AWA tag team runner, the 200 slim trim 17 pounds. There was a lot more to it.
He's a guy that, I mean, I really miss him, you know, when, and it's how many years since he passed away. And even though you have that lapse of time, that's kind of the nature of the wrestling business too. If you know somebody, you're friends with them, you don't see him for years, and then you run into him at a Cauliflower Alley club or whatever, you kind of pick up right where you left off. And that's the way it was with Buddy and I. And I mean, I could tell you stories that really aren't fit for a podcast as far as some of the shenanigans that he would get into outside of the ring before he got into the wrestling business. Character doesn't even begin to describe who he was. And, you know, as you look back on it, and I think people endure this in life generally when they see somebody that they know, they respect, they love or whatever, kind of going down the wrong path and kind of self-destructing. You just want to take them and shake them and say, hey, you know, knock this off. Stop it. You don't know what you're doing here. And I think in Buddy's case, that's what happened. Like I said, the last time I saw him in Las Vegas, it was pretty clear this was a ticking time bomb. The guy, poor guy, couldn't even stand up from the table without getting red-faced and fighting for air and what have you. So kind of let himself go, and for whatever reason, he didn't try to set the train back on the track, and as a result, we lost him way too soon. I feel that even not as an active performer or competitor, like an Eddie Gilbert, there was so much more that this guy could have done in the wrestling business behind the scenes with television or broadcasting or promoting or what training, whatever it was. And the young guys of today got shortchanged, period.
Yeah, he trained a lot of guys who are still in the Northwest scene, and everybody talks very highly of Buddy. But I think if you're listening to this and you only know the 217 slim trim Buddy Rose, I hope this has given you a little bit more background as far as, you know, Buddy in Minnesota, Buddy in Texas, Buddy in the Pacific Northwest, Buddy in the early WWF with Bob Backlund and such. But like I said, I think I really appreciate this, Mick. I've been wanting to do this for a while. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure. And I got to say, Jim, good luck to you. I understand this is the last live cast you're going to be doing for a while. And I got to tell you, having me on, you really went out with a cap gun. More power to you.
You know, I enjoyed this thoroughly. I think there's a lot of good stories, and I think there's a lot of good information, and that's what I tried to bring to the live cast. But as I mentioned, you can still follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley, and I'm going to be doing I'm still going to be doing Cauliflower Alley Radio, which you can download at CauliflowerAlleyClub.org. And you can also follow me, as I mentioned, on Twitter at Jim Valley, and then the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast with Fumi Saito. Just for search for Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and it should pop right up. Are there any social channels where people can get in contact with you, Mick?
Nobody gets in contact with me, Jim. The only place I am is on Facebook. I live there. I really do. I take the computer to bed with me. I've got it on all the wrestling sites. I would say that what I'm doing right now, I'm heavily involved with Steel Domain Wrestling here in the Twin Cities. I would encourage wrestling fans to go to their website. SDW has spawned Ken Anderson, CM Punk, Adam Pearce, Austin Aries, a lot of guys like that. So still staying active in the business. I'm still out there, and anytime I can talk old school with anybody, I really appreciate it. And I thank you a million for this opportunity to talk about Paul.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to do that. Are you going to be at Cauliflower Alley in April and May?
I am going to be there, absolutely. I would hope that you will be as well.
Yes. We have to honor the Baron.
We'll get together, and I'll buy you a soda.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing you there, Mick. Thanks so much for everything, and we will be in touch. So thanks, Mick. I really appreciate your time, and have fun in the very deep snow in Minneapolis.
Thanks a lot, pal. Talk to you later.
All right, there we go. There's Mick Karch dialing up here on the live cast. As I mentioned, it's my last live cast. I've got to go and get a real job. But you know the way my jobs always go. I'll probably be back in a little while. You never know. Anyway, follow me on Twitter at Jim Valley. I'm also on Facebook, Jim Valley. You can find me there. Just send me a message so I know that you're not a webcam girl. And then also be sure to listen to the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast with Fumi Saito. He's a genius when it comes to wrestling and wrestling history. Just search for Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast on iTunes and give it a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. And also, I'll still be doing the Cauliflower Alley Club Radio, which is out there. We have our first episode talking with Baron Von Raschke, and we'll have our next episode coming up in just a few weeks. So stand by and listen for that. So thank you for listening. Thank you for the great numbers. I appreciate you always being so kind and always listening and downloading. Thank you to Wade for having me on and putting up with me. But we will see you down the road. But remember, Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast and Cauliflower Radio Podcast as well. So CauliflowerAlleyClub.org and the Pacific Rim Pro Wrestling Podcast. And we will see you later. All right. Till next time. Bye.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, I invite you to get even more of what the Torch offers by becoming a PW Torch VIP member. Not only do you get ad-free access to our website, the mobile site, and the desktop site, and access to about 30 years of our archives, including over 1,500 back issues and thousands upon thousands of hours of our audio shows going back to 2004, plus tons of retro radio shows from the 1990s, but you also get over 15 VIP exclusive podcasts per week, in addition to ad-free editions of these PW Torch livecasts throughout the week. So we take the ads out of the PW Torch livecast for VIP members and then give you over 15 other podcasts per week, including what started it all, the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show. I host that with Bruce every weekend, and we spend a couple hours talking about the biggest stories of professional wrestling and wrestling history. It's one of the longest-running weekly pro wrestling podcasts on any subject. And it's one of the main reasons people go VIP and stay VIP. Another is The Fix with Todd Martin. I host that every midweek with Todd, and we get Todd's expertise and opinions every midweek on current events in professional wrestling, not just WWE, but all promotions worldwide, including New Japan. Plus, we end every show with some expert MMA talk from the LA Times columnist and SureDog contributor, Todd Martin. And there's so much more. The Every Single Day Weight Killer Hotline with news updates every single day, Monday through Friday. And every Saturday and Sunday, I do the Ask the Editor format of the Weight Killer Hotline, where I answer VIP member questions in depth. And there's so much more. There's the Wayback Playback with Pat McNeil and Jim Valley, Wrestling Audio Community with Sean Radican, the WWE Future Past Show with scouting reports on prospects and a look back at the indie career of current stars, the PW Torch East Coast Cast Extended VIP Edition, the retro radio shows. Every Thursday, a new retro radio show from the 90s drops, from the early 90s or the Attitude era. And last but not least, my in-depth Raw and SmackDown reports. You can get a full chronological rundown of every episode of Raw and SmackDown with my analysis of the show in-depth every Monday night and Tuesday night. So check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. We give you a lot here at the live cast, but there is so much more. The vast majority of our work is for our VIP members, and you can become one today. Go check out details on a subscription at pwtorch.com/govip.
No.